Thanks for joining us on Battle Walks as we walk across the great battlefields of Europe. If you're enjoying the show, why not become a member? Every week, you'll receive exclusive bonus episodes available only to subscribers, and you can listen to all our episodes completely ad-free. Click on the link in the show notes to join us via Acast Plus.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Matt McLaughlin.
And I'm Pete Smith.
We're battlefield historians who love nothing better than getting out and walking the ground where great battles in history took place.
And now we'd like you to come with us. Every week, Battle Walks will take you to one of the great battlefields of Europe.
As we walk the ground, we'll dig through the pages of history, we'll uncover the secrets of the battlefields, and most importantly, we'll tell the stories of the people who fought and died there.
Welcome to Battle Walks.
Hello everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Battle Walks, a special destination with a special guest host. We are doing Arnhem, Operation Market Garden, the World War II invasion of Holland, the big Allied ploy to win the Second World War in one fell swoop. And joining us to talk all about it is Battlefield Guide to the Stars. It's Joe Hook. Joe, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Thanks. It's great to be back on. Looking forward to talking with you, Matt.
Now, this is a very special battlefield for you, isn't it? I should say at the outset, it's one that I haven't actually been to. I've been to a small part of the Market Garden area in the Netherlands, but I haven't actually been to Arnhem and this area. So it's going to be a really fascinating one for me. I'm really joining the listeners in learning all about this. It's an area that you love on the battlefields, though, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah, it is. It's one of the very first battlefields I really got to know in depth. And I didn't initially want to do it because, it's very closely knit to the parachute regiments. And it was something that had really not taken my notice, really. And I got to do it because I was working for a tour company who wanted a guide embedded in Germany to take military groups. And so I thought, okay, I'll go and do the recce, went over there, and I fell in love with it. It's a battle of what ifs. It's actions that are just astounding. And the area it's fought over, certainly for the British, so I'm just talking about the British today, is walkable, and it hasn't changed a lot.
Well, let's start by you giving us your really quick potted history of this area. What was Market Garden all about, and what's the area we're going to specifically be walking today?
Okay, so very quickly, in a quick summary, Market Garden is, once we've broken out of Normandy, we've really, really pushed a battered German army up through to Belgium. But at that point in time, our supplies, we're still being resupplied back from Normandy. And really, there's a question of, do we have a broad front push? Which we can't do because of resupplies. And so Montgomery comes up with a plan, and that is to drop a carpet of airborne troops, two American divisions, one British division, up a pencil-like area from the Belgian-Netherlands border up through, in the hope that they can outflank the Siegfried Line and head into Germany. So airborne troops dropping, capturing vital objectives that ground troops are going to then push northwards up a 64-mile corridor. The hope is to be in Berlin by Christmas.
And the really important question, Joe, were they in Berlin by Christmas?
No. But there is a what if to that, which I shall probably come on to towards the end of the show. Montgomery said it was 90% successful, and I would say it was 75% successful, definitely.
Okay, but it didn't achieve quite the great victory that the Allies had envisaged.
No, it didn't achieve the outcome they'd envisaged, but it did liberate a large part of the Netherlands.
Well, we're going to be focusing on the area around the city of Arnhem, and this is the British area of operations. Tell us a little bit about what went on here and the overview of the ground we're going to be walking.
So most of the ground is... it's not as flat as you would think of it is in that part of the Netherlands. It is a little bit rolling. It is the furthest most objective, and we had three airborne divisions. So from south to north, 101st American Airborne Division would drop in the area of Eindhoven, which is the southernmost point. It's not far from the Belgian border. And then moving northwards, you would have the 82nd. And right up at the top of Arnhem, you have the 1st Airborne Division. And the idea is that ground troops are going to move up through those vital, which we hope to be captured objectives, mainly bridges over the main waterways, until they get to the Arnhem Bridge, held by the 1st British Airborne Division, or hoped to be held by the 1st British Airborne Division, at which point they'll cross the bridge and then armour 30 Corps, commanded by a guy called General Horrocks, will pass through them and head on to into the industrial heartland of the Netherlands. It's hoped that the 1st Airborne Division are going to be holding that bridge at Arnhem, but they have various obstacles or things that happen after their drop that mean that only the northern end of the bridge is held by them. And that's something I'm going to be chatting to you about a bit later on.
Well, it's good walking country, isn't it? As you mentioned, it's great to get out and stroll around, and it's a relatively compact area. Let's get on with it. Let's start walking, because I'm fascinated to hear about this. Where are we going to begin our tour of the Arnhem battlefield?
Okay, so we're going to begin our tour on a road called the Wolfhazeweg, and it's drop zone X-ray for the men of the 2nd Parachute Battalion. And we start at a little car park. There's a little car park, pretty nondescript car park. It's a beautiful area. It's all heathland, very similar to the land these men would have trained on in areas of Aldershot prior to coming out to Market Garden, or very similar to the areas where the Paras had their headquarters. But it is all heathland, little quite affluent villages. So Wolfhazer is the nearest village, and right on this spot that we are stood, it's like a car park, just a little pull-in. At about 12:30 on the 17th of September, if you'd looked up in the sky, you'd have seen 180 men of the Pathfinders coming down, and what their job is to do is to parachute drop in to certain areas known as DZs, drop zones for parachutists, landing zones for gliders, and their job is to actually mark out the area, and they'll use various pieces of equipment, Eureka beacons, marking lights for the incoming main assault, which is due to drop about 40 minutes after those pathfinders originally, first of all, drop. And this is where we stood this morning, where the pathfinders would come in. It's a Sunday afternoon. It's a sublime late September Sunday afternoon. The area has been bombed that morning, pre-drop bombardment. And so the area has been bombed. The asylum, which we would walk that through, which is by Wolfhazer, that is bombed. And about 80 of the inmates from the asylum are killed in that bombing. It's a softening up raid. But actually, this is a Sunday afternoon. It's that late September, a Sunday afternoon. The local people are not expecting anything to really be happening.
How many paratroops dropped in this area, Joe, and on how many drop zones?
So off the top of my head, so you're talking about thousands of paratroopers. So the area, the whole, the division is about 10,000 strong, but not the whole of the division will be dropping on that one day. That's one of the problems with Market Garden, is the division is going to be dropped over a course of 3 days. And obviously, by the time you've got paratroopers dropping out of the sky on the second day, you lose any element of surprise because there are German troops within the area. They're also going to be dropping something like 8 miles from the Arnhem Bridge again, which means that they're going to have to get to the bridge itself. And that again, if you've got German troops in the area, which we have, we know about them, but we believe they're quite low level troops. Again, you're going to lose that element of surprise. So over the 3 days, about 10,000 troops are going to be dropping on a number of different DZs and LZs. So DZX, which we'd be standing at now, will be turned into a landing zone for gliders on the second day. And then on the third day, you will have men who are attached to the 1st Airborne Division, 1st Independent Polish Parachute Squadron. They will also be dropping in. And the idea is they're going to be dropping, their paratroopers dropping at the southern end of the Arnhem Bridge, while their gliders will be dropping north of Arnhem. The whole idea is over 3 days, they are all going to move towards Arnhem and provide a major defensive perimeter at the bridge. But it doesn't happen like that.
So the concept basically is that the paratroops will capture key objectives and then hold onto them and wait for the land forces to arrive, because obviously one of the issues with paratroops is they can drop infantry with their light weapons, but they can't take any heavy weapons with them. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a really fair assessment. And for the 2nd Parachute Battalion, they have got the three main objectives. And the three main objectives that they are earmarked to take are the railway bridge in Arnhem, on their route into Arnhem. So now they're about 8 miles away from their, it's about seven, eight miles away from their first objective. Their first objective is the railway bridge. It's been earmarked. We've seen it on the maps. The second objective is a small pontoon bridge that sits today just about a kilometre east, say a bit less than a kilometre east of the main Arnhem Road Bridge. And then also their final objective is the main Arnhem Road Bridge itself. And that is the objective for 2nd Parachute Battalions. The other parachute battalions, the 1st and 3rd, who will be dropping on the same day, so dropping in the area just where we are stood, their objective is to make their way on routes that run parallel to the 2nd Parachute Battalion towards the bridge. Everything is dropped in the west, pushing, I never get this right, the west pushing eastwards towards the bridge, but their routes will run parallel to each other, given code names Tiger, Leopard and Lion. And the idea is that 2nd Parachute Battalion have got the objectives of the bridges, but the 1st and 3rd Parachute Battalions are going to be moving with them, running parallel, but eventually will form that whole defensive perimeter. And then you've got your air landing men who come in on the gliders. So the glider pilots for the British, they will, once they land, they will revert to an infantry role. So our glider pilots did, as opposed to the Americans. And then you have got the air landing brigades all coming in by gliders, the King's Own Scottish Borderers, 2nd South Staffords and the 1st Border Regiment, again, will form that, be part of that defensive perimeter. So you've got a huge amount of troops, but as you say, lightly rolled and lightly armed.
So we've had a look at the area where the Pathfinders came in, obviously a vital part of the opening phases of the battle. What's next on our tour?
So the next part on our tour is a really key spot, and it's one of the places I think everybody goes to. If you're down in Arnhem on the commemorations, everybody will go to a place called the Culvert. So from where we are at the moment, we head down to into the village of Wolfhazer itself, and we turn left across the railway line, and then there's a little road called Johannehoveg, and you go, it goes into a track that runs parallel to the railway line. And on the 17th of September, Urquhart, who is the divisional commander for the 1st Airborne Division, he knows that his parachute battalions, 1st, second and third are going to take quite a while to rendezvous and get to the bridge. So he's earmarked his recce squadron, who is a guy called Goff. The commander is a guy called Major Goff. And he said to him, I want the recce squadron to get in their jeeps, so their jeeps come down by glider, and marry up with them as quickly as possible and race to the bridge, almost to, in a coup de main, attempt to hold the bridge and await these slower oncoming parachute battalions. And it's at this point, if we walk down this track, it's a dusty track. Again, it hasn't changed a lot. It dips down and then it dips up again. Where it dips down, so you're on the northern side of the railway line, to your right, there is a culvert, a little bridge, and it is tiny. I'm 5 foot, and I'm the only person I know that can walk under it standing up. You have to bend your head. You can get a Willys Jeep under it. But to your left, you come into an open area of heathland. And when the paras dropped, when 1st Airborne Division dropped on that morning, they know that there are German troops in the area. The one key German troop in the area is a guy called SS Captain Kraft, Sepp Kraft, and he commands the 16th SS Training Battalion, and he's got his men deployed in the area of the drop that morning. Just by sheer coincidence, they're practicing anti-invasion, anti-airborne drops that morning. He's got about 345 men under his command, and the place where we walk down this track. To your right, you've got the railway embankment with the culvert. Then to your left, you've got an area of high ground. And he deploys his men on both this area. And the high ground is to the left of the path we're going to walk down. And to the right, you've got the railway embankment. So basically, he deploys them there. And it's a classic ambush position. Once the airborne drop, it's Cresswell is the guy who is, I'm pretty sure his name's Cresswell. He's the guy that is earmarked to marry up with his squadron, the recce squadron, and race to the bridge. And he's got about three jeeps with him. And he takes the first jeep. There's a bit of confusion with the jeeps marrying up. Some of them don't appear straight away. But he takes the first jeep that appears. He tells his wireless operator, Arthur Barlow, he said, you wait for the other jeeps. He grabs another couple of men with him, and he races to the bridge. And two of his jeeps have gone on behead in front of him. He leaps frog through them. He goes down the track, and he's the lead jeep. And he enters this area of heathland, and he literally enters the killing zone. Because as his jeep goes past the Germans who are ensconced on the railway embankment and this piece of high ground, they open up on him. And there's a firefight with the jeeps coming on behind. But the consequences of it mean it's now left to the 2nd Parachute Battalion to make their way to the bridge. And also the enemy are now on full alert. I think the Pathfinders drop, they drop about 12:30. The main assault drops about 1:30. By 2:30, the SS Corps commander who commands this two armoured divisions, the 10th and the 9th, by 2:30 he's already sending out orders for his men to deploy to stop the paras reaching the bridge. So where we are in this culvert, again, it hasn't changed. Everybody comes down here for commemorations. You get the Dutch, they go driving their Willys jeeps through. If you lay the windshield flat, you can go through. But it's a real iconic spot for this battle, and it also has it will also play a big part. After all defense at the bridge fails, the 1st Airborne have to drop back into a pocket of land known as the perimeter or the Hexenkessel, the Witch's Cauldron, and the one of the only ways of getting over that railway embankment or underneath it safely is via this culvert. And so this is a number of days after, when all defence at the bridge has fallen, we drop back. The Germans are pushing us back into a pocket. Think of Dunkirk being pushed back into a pocket, which they hold. And loads of troops try and get under this particular area. So it's an iconic part of the battlefield.
Sounds unbelievable. I'm looking forward to getting over there, Joe. What's next on the tour?
So next, we then, because we are following 2nd Parachute Battalion, we have to kind of backtrack a little bit. We go past the original drop zone. So we take our, if you're in a car, you can bypass it a little bit, but we go past the place where we were standing, where all the RV happened, the drop zones, and we enter a village called Helsum and Renkum. And this is really where, in the village of Helsum, is where Lieutenant Colonel John Frost, who commands the 2nd Parachute Battalion, he has his rendezvous. So he's getting all his men together, and he will use bugle calls to rendezvous. Now, if you watch A Bridge Too Far, the film, iconic film, you'll see that they talk about radio crystals and all that. That's a little bit not quite correct. Radios, communications at Arnhem was difficult. One of the reasons it was difficult is because of the ground there. Even up until the 80s and 90s, the Dutch people living in the area had problems tuning into their televisions because of the ground. Also, you put a radio, any type of radio, into a glider or a man pack where you carry it in a backpack, and communications are going to be difficult because communications, or sophisticated radio communications, were still very much in their infancy. So as kind of a backup, Lieutenant Colonel Frost has said, okay, I'm going to rendezvous, I'm going to call all my men in on a bugle call. And he has a bugle with him. That bugle can still be seen in the Hartenstein Museum in the village of Oosterbeek. But he calls all these men, they rendezvous, and this is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They do hear machine gun fire in the background, but Frost knows his objective is to get to the bridge. And very soon after about 3 o'clock, they start making their way along what was known as Route Lion. It's a road called the Benenden Dorpsweg, which they eventually drop down to, which is the closest road to the Neder Rhine, the lower Rhine. And they will be making their way along the Rhine to their first objective. And their first objective is to be undertaken by Major Dover from C Company.
So what is there to see in this area, Joe, that that reminds us of what was going on during the war?
You go through a beautiful affluent area of Dorworth, wooded countryside, and the first real significant place you come to is a place called, the name escapes me now. Let me think. It's a piece of high ground, and it is literally just gone out of my mind, but it's a real piece of high ground that overlooks the Lower Rhine. It'll come back to me in a minute. But this is, again, another iconic area. It's the one piece of high ground that was vital for the British to hold. And there's a cafe on there now, and you can literally look down onto the Lower Rhine, and you can see all the way back to Nijmegen. And Nijmegen is where the 82nd Airborne Division were. And it just gives you a real good overview of how close 30 Corps, when the ground troops, when they came up towards Arnhem, how close they actually got. And at this area, let me think about what's it called. No, names just escaped me. But you can also see where, once the British have been pushed into this pocket, this is the eastern side, it's the eastern side of the perimeter. And when the British have been pushed into this perimeter pocket, they're trying to, the Dorsets try and reinforce there, the Polish try and reinforce there, and they have to reinforce across the Rhine. There's, when the 1st Border Regiment get there, they hold this particular area until they're pushed off there by German troops. Both sides know, because it's a piece of high ground, how important it is. And that's the first place we stop. And I always stop there and show people, you know, that Rhine is literally just below us. Nijmegen is 11 kilometres. On a clear day, you can see Nijmegen. And you can just see and almost feel how close the British ground troops got to actually relieving the airborne troops who were at this position. As we make our way along.
Are there any memorials in this area, Joe, to the troops who fought there?
Yeah, so you have a memorial at this particular position. There's a cafe up there now. So you've got a memorial to the 1st Border Regiment, who held the position until eventually they were pushed off by German troops, but also to the Dorset Regiment. And it was the Dorset Regiments that tried to reinforce this perimeter. So there's two memorials on the cafe that you can stand, and quite a lot of people take photographs. Around the time of the commemorations, you'll often see wreaths at the area.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And where to next on our tour of the battlefield?
Right, so next we drop down, carrying along on this road that runs parallel to the Rhine, and another real iconic place is a place known as the Torhorst House. Now, for those of you or anyone that's watched A Bridge Too Far, you will have seen Kate DeHorst. She's played by Liv Ullmann in the film. And Kate DeHorst was a Dutch woman living in Oosterbeek at the time of the drops. She had her children still living with her. Her husband had seen the parachutist dropping out of the sky, realised what was going on, immediately donned an orange armband to denote he was Dutch, and had gone into Arnhem to see what help he could give to any resistance in Arnhem itself. And Kate is left with her three children. And during the battle, the medical officer for the 1st Airborne Division, a guy called Graham Warwick, he knocks on her door and asks her, if possible, if she would be able to take in casualties in the cellar in her house. And eventually, when things didn't turn out at Arnhem quite as the British Airborne Division wanted it to turn out, they didn't. When all defence at the bridge had failed, her house became a regimental aid post, and something like 57 soldiers were buried in her garden after the battle. But throughout, she provided comfort to the troops in the cellar. She would read to them from the Bible. She would hold men's hands, and they died in her house. And it's a real iconic house still owned by the same family. And they were quite a tragic family because Kate, after the war in the 90s, was tragically killed in a car accident just outside her house. And her son was killed after the war out on the fields behind the house, was killed by a mine, probably from the Second World War. But she is a real, she was an iconic figure. And to the men of the 1st Airborne Division, her daughter Sophie, who still lives in the horse, the house, and who I've met Sophie, they will open up their gardens generally to the men from the 1st Airborne Division, to visitors, even today. And she has memorials in her garden. Although I would sort of say, to the caveat, that they are quite a private family, and you do sometimes get people sort of trying to enter the garden without permission, so you have to be quite careful. The house, though, also sits next to the old kirk, so old church, and it was the oldest church in the Netherlands at the time. It goes back to the 13th century, and the Parras would have gone past it. And here on the second morning, the 18th, some of the guns were just by the church. You've got a wall, you'll see a wall surrounds the church, and the guns here were placed from the artillery. They had gun emplacements there. I think it was 70mm pack howitzers. And they were able to actually fire onto the bridge. So the gunners, they had really good communications. They had about the best communications. But there was a gun battery placed here. Their code name was Mike 1. And when the bridge at Arnhem was attacked on the 18th of that morning, they were able to fire onto the bridge. There is nothing of the guns there, but you can actually see the position where they were put there.
It's a fascinating area, Joe. I mean, how much, you've mentioned a couple of buildings that are iconic in the history of the fighting. How many of those buildings still remain? Or was it an area that we should think of like the First World War, where everything was razed to the ground?
Loads of the buildings still remain. One of the things that most guides do when we go out is we do then and now photographs, and you can get really, really good then and now photographs. I mean, the church was pretty much destroyed. The spire was knocked off it. Houses were damaged. But generally, the whole area around Oosterbeek, you can bring up a photograph of what it looked like during the battle. I mean, windows were knocked out and buildings were damaged. But they have been built to what they looked like before. So there's a lot of the area you can see that is very what it would have looked like during the battle. And you can still see battle damage and scarring. The church itself is pockmarked with battle damage on it.
Well, we've walked past the church, and where are we heading to next?
So as we walk past the church, we're going to walk past a fork in the road. It's actually a track. And this is the first point that we've reached the first objective. In the distance, you can see the railway bridge. And this is the objective of C Company led by a guy called Major Dover. And they peel off from the main route of advance. So the 2nd Parachute Battalion, plus elements of the 1st Parachute Brigade, are making their way to the bridge. They peel, Major Dover peels off, and together with his company of men, they get up onto the railway bridge itself, onto the railway line. And because they've been fairly oofing it down to the, towards the Arnhem Bridge, they stop for a moment, drop their packs, and just stop and take a breather. And it's probably a good job they do, because the whole of the railway bridge goes up. It had been charged for demolition. Those charges had gone up, and right where they are, there's no way they can now get over the railway bridge south in order to run parallel on the other side of the Rhine to reach the southern part of the main road bridge. So their first objective is already destroyed. But as we move down the road, we go underneath the railway line, and there's a story as you go underneath the railway line. This is the first point, really, that 2nd Parachute Battalion are going to experience enemy, come into contact with the enemy. And it's from the railway line. And Lieutenant Peter Crane, he goes up onto the railway line with his platoon of men. And in his platoon, he's got two brothers, Tom and Claude Grunart. And their story is a fairly, it's a note, it's a well-known story. Both of them were tin miners from Cornwall, and they enlisted at the same time. So their army numbers are just one number apart. And they're twins. They were born on the same day. And they go up onto the railway line with Lieutenant Peter Kane. And the railway bends round into Arnhem. And on that bend, there's two kind of stories here. One is that the Germans open up with machine gun fire. And the other story is that a German walks towards them with a white flag offering to surrender. And anyhow, Tom Grunart goes forward. And as he goes forward, he's hit by enemy machine gun fire. And he lies on the railway line, mortally wounded. And Claude hears his brother screaming and obviously runs towards to see what he can help him. And he is also hit. And he is also killed. And they're buried today at the Oosterbeek Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery together. Obviously, their dates of birth are the same. Their date of death is the same. And their army serial number is one number apart. And that is a popular story. Everybody goes to visit the Grunart twins. But many years ago, I think it was on the 60th anniversary, I took out the Parachute Regimental Association of Cornwall. So where they would have, had they survived the war, they'd probably been part of that association. And one of the passengers was on board, and she had been the lady that Tom, prior to going to Market Garden, Tom and Claude had got a bit of downtime and they'd gone back home. They'd got a 48-hour pass. And they were stood on the railway line. They were stood at the railway station to go back to First Airborne prior to deployment. And she said, I knew there was something wrong with Tom. I knew he didn't want to go back. And I asked him what was wrong. And he said, I don't think I'm going to come back from this one. And she said, I remember saying to him, just go and catch the train. Go and catch the train. The war's going to be over by Christmas. And then we can come back and we can all celebrate properly. And she was on my coach. And we went as close to the railway line as we possibly could get. And she had a little cross. And she put it down. And all it said on it was, you should never have caught the train.
How do you find that, Joe? I mean, you've had the rare privilege of speaking to a lot of veterans from this. I mean, these personal stories, we can walk the battlefields and we can see historic sites, which is always very moving. But those stories, those personal stories must stay with you as you walk this ground.
They very much do. I mean, I have been so privileged to meet a lot of the Arnhem veterans. So I've had friends who were, one in particular, I have to thank the introduction. Mike Peters, another of your guides for Matt McLaughlin, he introduced me to a guy called Peter Clark. And Peter Clark was a really good friend of mine. And we became good friends because we both grew up a generation apart in the same area. And he would say to me, Joe, I used to ride my bike down Saltbox Hill and I rode my bike down the same hill. We went to school just, you know, about a mile apart from each other. And Peter Clark, I mentioned earlier, with the glider pilots, the British glider pilots, once they got on the ground, they took on the role of infantry troops. And Peter Clark was a medic. And so he looked after the wounded. And at the end of the battle, the 1st Airborne Division, the majority of them evacuated back across the Rhine, those that were able and fit to do so. But because Peter was a medic, he had wounded to look after. And so he had the choice, do I stay with the wounded and look after them and consequently be captured by the enemy? Or do I evacuate myself? I'm fit, I'm able to do so. Do I go back across the Rhine with the rest of the division? And he stayed and looked after the wounded. And consequently, he became a prisoner of the enemy, and he was taken to one of the stalags in Germany and eventually was liberated by Americans at the end of the war. And after the war, he used to phone me up and I used to phone him up and we used to email each other all the time. But he kept a diary and he said to me, Joe, and he had this very clipped English accent, very, you know, that kind of 1930s black and white film accent. And he said, Joe, I really do need to get this diary transcribed. And I took it off him and I transcribed it all. And so Peter died about 2 or 3 years ago now, and I remember the morning he died. But I'm so glad I transcribed that diary for him, because it's now in perpetuity at the Airborne Museum. It's on a website called Paradata, and anyone can look it up. So there's a little bit of his history still lives on.
That's wonderful, Joe. Well done. That is obviously an incredibly significant connection. I'm jealous of the connection you've had with these heroes of Arnhem. And speaking of these guys, where are we heading in their footsteps next?
Okay, so we leave our first objective. That's the railway bridge, and the second objective is the objective of B Company. Is the pontoon bridge. Now, there's nothing left of the pontoon bridge today, but to mark it is a bridge. It's a modern day bridge. It's called the Nelson Mandela Bridge, and it's a modern day 1970s structure. But that is virtually the position as we're walking down now. We're entering the outskirts of Arnhem. We've passed a building called St. Elizabeth's Guest House, and at that point, the road splits, and you've got a high point of the road and the lower road, and we're going to follow the lower road. But at that point where we pass St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the 16th Parachute Field Ambulance, they peel off, because St. Elizabeth's Hospital, again, a really iconic building, and its facade is exactly the same today as it was during the battle. That is there. That's been earmarked for them to set up a field hospital there. And most passengers, 100%, 99% of passengers will visit the St. Elizabeth's Hospital, because it's also the area where later on in the battle, General Urquhart, the divisional commander, he gets trapped in a house just by St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which means he's out of the battle for a full 24 hours. It's all around this area. But for us, we're following 2nd Parachute Battalion. The Nelson Mandela Bridge earmarks the spot where the pontoon bridge is, B Company's objective. By the time they get to it, however, the centre section of the bridge has been destroyed. So there's the second objective that we're unable to take. So everything now hinges on the 2nd Parachute Battalion being able to take the main Arnhem Road Bridge.
And what happens in that chapter? We're getting to the crescendo of the fighting. Tell us about the 2nd Paras and the Arnhem Bridge.
Yeah. Okay, so Frost has got a depleted 2nd Parachute Battalion. He's got most of his C Company are still back trying to at the railway bridge. B Company has peeled off to take the pontoon bridge. So Frost has got what's left of his men together with elements of 1st Parachute Brigade. He gets to the bridge. He begins to form a defensive perimeter. Now, this defensive perimeter means that they're going to enter houses. They're going to knock out glass windows. They're going to start to get the houses ready for defence. And at the moment, Frost knows he's only got the northern end of the bridge. He needs to take the southern end of the bridge. And various attempts are made. But the very last attempt is made by two glider pilots manhandling a 6-pounder anti-tank gun up onto the bridge. And the steps are still there where they took this gun up. They'll turn the gun at 180 degrees and fire onto a pillbox on the bridge where already enemy troops have been spotted. At the same time that they manhandle this gun up onto the bridge, I think his name's Sapper Wilkinson, I'm pretty sure his name's Sapper Wilkinson, will fire a flamethrower from the eastern side of the bridge into the pillbox. This happens. It doesn't work out quite as well as they want, because there's an ammunition bunker right behind it, and the whole lot goes up like the 4th of July fireworks party, by which time the enemy is now fully on alert. Prior to the 2nd Parachute Battalion getting to the Arnhem Bridge, though, a deployment of German troops at about 6 o'clock that night. 2nd Para gets there about 7, 8 o'clock at night. But about 6 o'clock, a deployment of the 9th SS Reconnaissance Battalion had been ordered to go down to Nijmegen. They're commanded by a guy called Victor Grabner. And on the second day, so the British get there on the 17th, they form their defensive perimeter on the 17th. But on the morning of the 18th, Grabner having gone down to Nijmegen, having done his recce down there, is sitting at the southern end of the Arnhem Bridge, surveying the British positions at the northern end of the bridge. Now, nobody really knows whether he is just... He's been awarded the Knight's Cross only 24 hours before, whether he sort of thinks, right, okay, I'm going to take out the British positions myself in a gung-ho attempt to do so, or whether he's just trying to get back to his own headquarters. He's got a number of vehicles with him, lorried infantry and half-tracks. So half-tracks is you've got like it's an open-like tank at the back with a half of it is tracked and half of it is wheeled. Does that make sense? Armoured vehicles. He's got 22 of these together with infantry troops. And he looks at the British positions at the northern end of the bridge. And what he knows is the British is on an apex. So you go up and over it. He knows that until he gets to the centre of that apex, he's got a bit of cover. And he sends his two lighter vehicles through first, and they go through past the British positions, and they manage to weave in and out of mines that the British have placed on the northern end of the bridge. And with almost sort of like a drop of his hand, he signals the start for his heavier vehicles to go across the bridge. The British who are at the northern end of the bridge, the first they're aware of anything is the bridge begins to kind of judder with this heavy armour starting to go across it. And initially, they think this is 30 Corps. So the British armoured troops coming up to rescue them, it's not 30 Corps. It's Grabner's men and his attack. And the British are told to hold their fire. They're in buildings that overlook the bridge ramp. So they have got the advantage of being able to look down on anything crossing that bridge. And initially, they hold their fire. And they wait until Grabner's vehicles get into a killing zone before they open up. And they open up with absolutely everything. Bren guns, grenades, rifle fire, Sten guns, all being fired on these half tracks. The lead half track, the driver balks, stops his vehicle, slams it into reverse and reverses it back into the second half track. And both of them fall off the eastern side of the ramp and are taken out by the paras in the buildings on the eastern side of the ramp. And literally, as the half tracks come to a halt, burning oil starts to spew across the bridge itself. This catches fire. A lot of the enemy troops, seeing that they're being fired on by the British from above them, and some of the British are throwing grenades into the open compartments of the half tracks, many men will jump into the Rhine as a way to get out of the British killing zone. Major Dennis Mumford, he's the artillery officer at the bridge. He calls in the guns that are back at the church. He calls them in with their call sign, Mike 1. They begin to fire onto the bridge. And there's this huge attack that will last most of the morning of the 18th. By the midday on the 18th, the attack has been petered out and the British are jubilant. You know, this is a high moment in their defence at the northern end of the bridge. But what it means for the Germans is that Arnhem Bridge is blocked, completely blocked. They cannot deploy armour further down south, down that corridor, to stop the British ground troops advance or the American airborne divisions.
It's a fascinating story, Joe. And can you feel that history when you go to the bridge? Can you stand on or near the bridge and get a good understanding of what happened that day?
You can to a point. You can, if you have a good guide, you can if you have a lot of pictures. I use a lot of pictures at the bridge because the bridge today, it was destroyed predominantly in 1945. So when after the British left Arnhem, the whole of the area of Arnhem was still in German hands. And in 1945, when Arnhem was eventually liberated, a lot of it was destroyed. So those beautiful old Dutch houses, there are still a few of them around the bridge area, but it looks nothing like today what it would have looked like in 45 because it was destroyed. So a lot of the structure there are 1970 structures. If you go into Arnhem Town itself, around there you've got two churches, St. Walburgis and St. Eusebius churches. There's still battle damage on those. But to a point you can, but to a point it has been built up with this 1970s quite ugly architecture. So I use a lot of pictures when I'm there.
Another battlefield where we need to use our imagination to see exactly what went on. But I think the ghosts always have their way of telling their story. I mean, this is, we're on the bridge now. This is really the end of our journey. I mean, a couple of very tough days of fighting followed, and then it was all over for the British, wasn't it, sadly?
Yeah, it was. So going into sort of like the 18th and 19th, what the Germans decide to do, once that bridge is blocked, they are literally going to annihilate the British at the northern end of the bridge itself. And the Germans have the advantage of armour. Now, the disadvantage for the armour is in 1945, some of these roadways to get into the bridge, to filter into the bridge, are narrow with high Dutch houses. So very difficult for the armour to penetrate, but they start penetrating on the eastern side of the bridge, and they will literally come in under the main ramparts of the bridge, fire, infantry go in, literally lobbing grenades through the buildings that the British are in. And if you're quick enough, you can catch it and lob a grenade out again. And it's fighting from house to house, from room to room. One of the, I don't use the word heroes a lot because I don't think British soldiers like to regard themselves as heroes, but one of the main characters here on the bridge, well, there's two main characters. One of them is a guy called Greyburn, and Greyburn sees the Germans coming underneath the bridge and trying to place demolition charges under it. What they want to do is take out the ramp, not the actual bridge itself. And he, together with a bunch of engineers, they try and destroy these demolition charges. And he effectively withdraws his men under enemy machine gun fire. He would have been one of the proliferate characters at the start of the when the British first got to the bridge trying to get to the southern part, but he's killed in the battle. His name is Greyburn, and he would be awarded the Victoria Cross for his actions on the bridge. If you watch the film A Bridge Too Far, he is a mishmash of the character Tatum Water, who is the man that carried the umbrella. So in A Bridge Too Far, you see the man that carries the umbrella. He also wore a bowler hat, Tatum Water. He would survive the war. Now, in the film, he gets killed, but he survives the war. And he has a fantastic story all his own. That there's a book recently been published on him because he manages to escape the enemy. And he's taken in by Dutch resistance. And eventually in the October of 45, Tatum Water, together with a guy called Tony Hibbert, will lead the largest escape attempt of the Second World War in an operation called Operation Pegasus, where the Dutch had looked after a lot of these men who'd been at the bridge and had managed to escape. But that's another story for another day. The eastern side of the bridge gradually is pretty much destroyed, and they're just small pockets of men that remain on the western side of the bridge. And the idea, Tatum Water, together with Gough, come up with an idea to withdraw the men from the bridge itself in the hope that they may regroup again on, I think, about the 20th of September, regroup and still form that defence at the bridge. But really, by the morning of the, of the 20th, all defence at the bridge has literally been destroyed. The British have managed to get up to Nijmegen, which is about 11 kilometres to the south. But really, all defence at the bridge is destroyed. And men are told to make their way to a pocket in a place called Oosterbeek. They will form a perimeter there and hold out, really, for another 5 or 6 days there in another part of the battle. Many of those at the bridge, of the 740 men, at the bridge, only 150 remain. The rest will be taken prisoner, killed or wounded. And one of the other little personal stories, if I may just tell you about it very quickly, is another person that I knew very well, and he was called Tony Hibbert. And Tony Hibbert was 1st Parachute Brigade Commander. He gets taken prisoner by the Germans. And when I first met him, he said, it was on the commemoration, he said, Joe, are you going up to Brummen, which is north of Arnhem, as part of your visit to Arnhem? And I said, didn't really know what happened at Brummen. I said, well, I wasn't intending to. And he said, well, you really must come. So Tony Hibbert, after the bridge fell, he got taken prisoner, put in a lorry with a number of other troops and taken other up. Originally, they were taken to a place called Velp, which is north of Arnhem, and then on to Brummen. And they're in a lorry, and it's Saturday. It's a market day. And the local people are at the market, and the lorries stop. And I don't know why they stopped, and I don't think Tony ever knew why they stopped. Might have been to replenish water or for whatever reason. And all the prisoners are taken off the lorry, and the Germans form a guard around them. And Tony Hibbert sees this as his one opportunity to escape. So he leapfrogs through the guard, runs through the local Dutch population, who close behind him. It's market day. They realise very quickly what he's done, closes behind him. And Tony Hibbert will eventually become part of that big Operation Pegasus, escape back across the Lower Rhine. What he didn't know was that in reprisal for his escape, the Germans shot 12 British troops, and they have a memorial at the post office at Brummen. And Tony Hibbert took it personally, and he said, I always visit Brummen because I feel personally responsible for the deaths of those men. Now, he died as well quite a few years ago, but I was up in Brummen last year, and we went to the post office, and Tony Hibbert's family still carry out that tradition of placing a wreath at the post office at Brummen.
Just extraordinary stories, Joe. I, you know, the combination of admiration and horror, and it's just incredible stories. It's an incredible battlefield, and as I said, I've only done a small part of the Market Garden battlefield, but I can't wait to get back over there. Perhaps when I'm over in Europe later this year, we'll get a chance to walk it together. But it's a fascinating story and brought to life by these touch points on the battlefield. Thank you so much for just sharing it with us.
It's my pleasure. It's a battle that I want to share with everybody because it gets to you. It really gets to your soul.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you would like to support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Firstly, you can become a member. For a small monthly fee, you could subscribe to the show and listen to every episode ad-free and also receive exclusive episodes directly from Pete and I. So see the link in the show notes to sign up at Acast Plus and become a member of the show. Also, if you want to make a one-off contribution, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit buymeacoffee.com/battlewalks and you can make a small contribution there. See you next week.